American Cassette Ministries is pleased to provide you with another presentation from the 2005 General Youth Conference in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Thousands of committed Seventh-day Adventist young people came together as an army on a mission to proclaim the three angels' messages to the whole world in this generation. They believe now is the time.
Welcome back. My name is still Nicholas Miller, and I'm still an attorney, fortunately. And I'm looking forward to this second segment. Let's begin again with a word of prayer, because this time we're going to look more closely at the Bible, and it's going to be more in the form of a Bible study. And I, of course, always want to ask for God's blessing and guidance as we open His Word. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank You again for life and for health. We thank You for Your presence with us this morning, and I pray now especially for the presence of Your Holy Spirit as we pause to open Your Word to look at ancient truths that shed light on the days in which we live. We thank You for Jesus, for His sacrifice and death for us, for the forgiveness and for the grace that He can give us to live in this dark and difficult age. I pray these things this morning in His name. Amen. So I ended the last segment, and I'm not sure I get a complete overlap of people from one to the other, just to briefly summarize, the question that I left the last segment with was, as Christians, as Adventists, what do we feel more threatened by on the political spectrum, in the political world? The political left that appears to reject moral absolutes, morality, that promotes abortion, that redefines marriage in whatever image it wishes, gay marriage, and it seems at times to want to purge all traces of religion from the public square. Is that the major threat? Or is it the religious right that in the name of morality seeks to impose narrow religious agendas on society, to send tax dollars to religious schools, impose its political will on Supreme Court nominations? They single-handedly defeated the nomination of Harriet Myers. It wasn't the left that defeated the president's candidate. It was a vocal and active religious right. Accepting only candidates that meet a strict religious litmus test. They can say Kennedy and O'Connor are the most dangerous justices in the Supreme Court and embrace a Scalia and a Rehnquist. What is it? How do we speak to a society that seems almost evenly split between these two very competing and warring camps? How do we speak out against immorality while still not falling into the far religious right? How do we speak out against the excesses of the religious right without being classed with the relativists and those that don't really believe in absolutes? Well, I think we've been given guidance on this question, and a study that I found helpful is found in Daniel 11. And it has to do with the King of the North and the King of the South. And those of you who know your Adventist history may remember that there was controversy in the 1880s and 1890s over this question, and Ellen White advised the brethren to leave well enough alone. It was causing more heat than light and more division. But I think that in the passage of time, that passions have cooled, and perhaps some things have become clearer. And I'm going to offer, I'm not going to pretend that it's the definitive understanding of this passage. I suppose we'll get that in heaven. But it is an understanding that at least several Adventist biblical scholars have accepted, and one that I should give credit to Russell Burrell in his book on the New World Order, laid some of the seeds out of which this particular study grew. And it shows, it helps us understand that not all conflicts are binary affairs, are on or off, two-sided, the good guys and the bad guys, the North and the South, Republicans and Democrats. We have a tendency to think that way. There's two teams on the field, and one's the winner and one's the loser. This conflict, the end of Daniel 11 and 12, involves three powers: the King of the North, the King of the South, and the King of Heaven. And he's represented in the battle by the people of God. And we're going to start there with the third group in Daniel 12:3. This is the passage where Michael stands up at the time of the end, during the time of trouble, to defend his people. And the people are described in a special way. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Now, there's a lot of ways to describe the people that live in the last days. The book of Revelation talks about having faith and keeping commandments. But this passage focuses on a particular characteristic, and that is wisdom. The wisdom, the wise of those that turn many to righteousness at the end. Somewhat unusual, but Daniel pictures a special role for wisdom to play in this group of people who are able, who are successful at the end in evangelizing their society, in turning many people to God. Of course, it's not merely human learning, head knowledge. The book of Proverbs says that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. You can only understand the larger questions of life when you have some humility yourself, when you have a fear of something greater. And I say a fear, a respect, a willingness and an ability to learn from God. But more clearly, James writes about this wisdom in James 3:17. And this is a key passage in understanding the kind of wisdom that these people have. James 3:17 says this: "The wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits." And there's a list of elements that wisdom is, but I'm focusing on those first two. First pure, then peaceable. Because those familiar with earthly systems of wisdom will understand how remarkable this is, for a system of wisdom to be first pure and then peaceable. Modern earthly wisdom suggests that those two are incompatible. That those who believe in a purity of doctrine or belief, who believe they can know some absolute truth or part of an absolute truth, they're called fundamentalists. They have a revelation from God. And it doesn't matter what religion you're in. They term them the same, don't they? Christian fundamentalists, and there's Muslim fundamentalists. And the thing that characterizes these people is that they think they can know something God is telling them through revelation, through the Bible. And these people cannot live peaceably with others, but invariably, if you believe you can know ultimate truth, you're going to impose that system of truth on other people. And that peace can only be had, so the reasoning goes, if we forswear any claims to absolute truth, except that all truth is relative, and that what works for you, and what works for me, works for me. This completely non-judgmental, I'm okay, you're okay, we're all okay. And nobody really knows truth, so we can have peace. And in fact, that's much of what our modern jurisprudence and systems of rights is based on. We have to respect other people's right to speak because we don't know what the truth is, and therefore the government shouldn't be deciding where the truth lies. So there's a system that says you can't have purity. You can have peace, but you have to deny that there's any kind of absolute system of truths. The other side says that, well, and the other side is apparent, that you can have truth, but if you have truth, you need to enforce it. And there's this middle way. The Bible says these people at the end of time have a wisdom that makes them both, it's both pure, systems of truth, but peaceable. There's something about this truth that is non-coercive, that allows them to invite and persuade people to worship and to love God, not to compel them or to force them. And I would suggest this morning that the two kings in Daniel 11 represent the two alternatives to this heavenly wisdom and this heavenly peaceableness and purity. One represents a purity of orthodoxy and belief, but is far from peaceable. The other rejects any notion of purity of belief, but claims to be peaceable. Neither of them is pure or peaceable. Who are they? The King of the North and the King of the South. Well, we begin with when the book was written. The King of the North and the King of the South were adjudged in relation to the nation of Israel. Who lay to the north of Israel? It was Babylon, was at least the invaders from the north came around the Fertile Crescent, and so Babylon was considered the king of the north. The king of the south was Egypt. That's where the enemies came from the south. But what happens in prophecy over time? Let's first look at the king of the north. And this is, there's not that much controversy in Adventism over the identity of the king of the north. Babylon was very quickly replaced in history by Rome, by the Roman Empire in the north, and eventually by Papal Rome. And after the death of Christ, when the symbols in Daniel take on a spiritual meaning rather than a physical geographical location, that seems to be the apt application. But let's look at some passages so that we can see that clearly ourselves. If you turn to Daniel 11, I'm going to read a passage from 31 to 36, and then we're going to look back at some earlier passages in Daniel 7, 8, and 9. 31 to 36 of Daniel 11. And forces shall be mustered by him, and we're talking about the king of the north, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Those who do wickedly against the covenant he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct yet many. Yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help. But many shall join with them in intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. And then verse 36 is particularly key. Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done. And verse 38, but in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses and a god which his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver. So keep those phrases in your mind and turn with me back a few chapters to Daniel 7:24. And I'm going to read a few texts. And 25, the ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom. And another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kings. We're talking about the little horn, which in other studies clearly is identified as the papacy. And he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change the times and laws. And the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, time, and half a time. And then 8, 10 to 12. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast down the truth to the ground and prospered. And in 9:27... And in the second half of it, and on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. And if you look at those three passages and compare them with the passage from Daniel 11, the same characteristics, the same animosity against God's people, the same persecution, the same taking up against and defiling the sanctuary and the sanctuary fortresses, and this becomes a key to our next study, as well as taking away the daily, the system of daily ministrations, and places there the abomination of desolation. So the parallel is very clear, and I think we have here an excellent historical example of a system that doesn't deny the existence of God or absolute truth. On the contrary, it uses the existence of God and absolute truth as an argument to enforce and to persecute. And it claims to have a monopoly on these truths as a basis for its persecution. To return to James, it has a wisdom that claims purity, but it is not peaceable. It's full of strife and contention. And cannot we see the spirit reemerging in the growing influence of the Catholic Church in American political matters, as well as the Protestant Christian right, with its increasing political involvement from everything to Supreme Court nominations, tax funding of religious programs, and choosing and a direct involvement in Supreme Court nominations. The King of the South is somewhat more interesting or difficult or uncertain. There are early arguments about this. Some thought it was Turkey, others maybe Islam generally, and since 9/11 there are those who think that it's best understood as being a resurgence of the Islamic power. And there may be something to that, but a view that seems to me to be supported by the Bible and the spirit of prophecy has to do with the French Revolution, atheism, and secularism. Remember, the literal king of the South power was Egypt. The earlier passages in Daniel fit in well with this, the dynasties, the Ptolemaic dynasties. But in verse 22, which is a reference to the death of Christ, what happens to that Egyptian power? What does it become? And we have a clue in the book of Exodus. Exodus 5:2 says that Pharaoh made this claim about God. Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go." So Israel in the Bible, or not Israel, but Egypt in the Bible, becomes identified with a denial of the true God. And we'll have questions at the end of the session, as we did last time. So for the first time in the Bible is recorded an open denial of knowledge of the true God. And later in the prophets, Egypt becomes synonymous with relying on man as opposed to relying on God. As Isaiah put it, "Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses, who trust in chariots because they are many and in horsemen because they are very strong, but who do not look to the Holy One of Israel, nor seek the Lord." Isaiah 31:1. So relying on Egypt became equated with relying on human strength and human resources, which is basically the essence of humanism. But these are kind of vague ideas, but they are explicitly connected with Egypt and last day events in the book of Revelation. And this is, I think, where I most clearly draw the connection. In Revelation 11:8. The passage begins by talking about the two witnesses who will testify in sackcloth and ashes for 42 months. And at the end of that period, they are slain and lie in the streets. And two witnesses, you can do the Bible study on this, representing two testaments, the New and the Old Testament, standing for witness of God's power and strength. They're clothed in sackcloth and ashes during this period because largely, for most of it, the common man and women didn't have the Bible. It was only until the Protestant Reformation, really, and afterwards that the Bible became more widely available. And they were first formally, destroyed. Atheism was set up as a formal creed for the first time at the end of this period in the French Revolution. The Bible was openly burned. Atheism was made the official decree of the nation. The French Revolution, unlike the American Revolution, was not just against the king, it was against the church. And the American Revolution had sympathy from the religious community, but in France, clerics and priests were killed, and the Catholic Church had become so identified, had joined so much with the state, that when they got rid of the state power, they got rid of the church power as well. Another historical example of the church being corrupted by a close affiliation with the state. But this is what Ellen White has to say about this passage in 11:8, and I'll read the passage first. "And their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. It's interesting that they put Egypt and Sodom together. And it's interesting to see what Sodom is identified with and what the left wing is often identified with these days in gay marriage and in defending that kind of activity. The Great Controversy, page 269. The great city in whose streets the witnesses are slain is spiritually Egypt. And she's talking about the French Revolution in this passage. She says this, of all nations represented in Bible history, Egypt most boldly denied the existence of the living God and resisted his commands. This is atheism, and the nation represented by Egypt would give voice to a similar denial of the claims of the living God and would manifest a like spirit of unbelief and defiance. The great city is also compared spiritually to Sodom. The corruption of Sodom in breaking the law of God was especially manifested in licentiousness. So Egypt, in biblical prophecy, is equated with a spirit of philosophical materialism, atheism, and moral relativism that manifested itself and has its roots in the French Revolution. Historians point to that as time as the beginning of modernity. These principles of skepticism, philosophical materialism, and atheism found their most formal manifestation in 20th century communism as a system based on a denial of the existence of God and on the philosophical principles found in the French Revolution. But, and some scholars see, if we go back to Daniel 11, verse 40, I had a father-in-law who I never met. He passed away before I met my wife, and he was a student of the Bible and of prophecy in the 1980s, long before communism fell. And based on this verse in Daniel 11:40, he anticipated and predicted the fall of communism, that the West and the papacy would combine in some way to bring about the end of communism. And here it is in verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the South shall attack him. The king of the South at the time of the end, the rise of secularism, of atheism, religion was in retreat all across Europe, and to some extent is today. Secularism has been a huge attack on religion, not just Protestantism, but Catholicism in the 19th and 20th century. But it says, the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. So it talks about the king of the north ultimately subduing and overcoming the king of the south. And communism indeed fell, and the papacy's involvement in it is no Adventist evangelist conjecture, but Time magazine in 1992 had a cover story on the Holy Alliance between America and the papacy as leading to the fall of communism, this very powerful combination. The king of the north came against him as a whirlwind. Whirlwinds act quickly. One moment the wall is there, the next moment it's gone. How did communism fall? It was just like that, wasn't it? Huge events. The Roman Empire took hundreds of years to fall. The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire is a book that covers 1,200 years. The fall of communism took about 2.5, and it seemed to happen overnight. But just because communism is largely gone doesn't mean that the spirit of the King of the South is gone. It remains in the philosophy of secularism, which permeates many of our institutions here in America, of higher learning, of the academy, often in the press. Popular modern philosophy is very secularistic and relativistic. It may not deny the existence of God, but it does tend to deny the validity of his laws or of moral truths and absolutes. It may claim to be peaceable, in the sense I mentioned earlier, I'm okay and you're okay, but it is not wisdom that is pure. It denies the existence of the ability to understand moral truths. So we have these two systems, and they are clashing today. The North, moralistic, absolutist, judgmental, and oppressive. The South, amoral, individualistic, without judgment, and tending towards lawlessness and moral breakdown. So in that contest, who's the good guy? Neither of them. Both of them threaten freedom in their own way. One of them threatens freedom by denying it, essentially, by saying we have to impose morality. The other threatens freedom by abusing it, by licentiousness, by saying there are no rules, you can do as you please, and the consequences follow. Both sides threaten freedom. This should caution us from setting up our flags in one camp or the other. It's not about the red states and the blue states, or the Republicans and Democrats. And don't get me wrong, I'm not here to say that the Republicans are the king of the North and the Democrats are the kings of the South. Both political systems are human systems, and at their extremes, they are dangerous to freedom. Both parties have politicians of goodwill who are trying to do good things and act in a balanced way. But more and more, it seems the extremes of both parties are becoming ascendant. The Republicans have shown themselves very capable of invoking a moral absolutism to justify the violation of individual and constitutional rights in the war on terror in the name of security and the collective. The Democrats have shown themselves all too willing to deny moral absolutes in defense of abortion on demand and gay marriage. The issues of protecting life and protecting family are not purely personal or religious, but they do impact our society, and we should care about them. We just cannot throw in our lot with those on the left who would have all those decisions as purely personal ones. Raising children. If you vote to allow for gay marriage, you are voting to allow gay couples to adopt children who are in all likelihood not gay and to be raised in a very particular sort of moral or amoral outlook. I cannot support that. But who wins ultimately? I guess the question started with that. Who are we more threatened by? Who is left standing at the end of the contest? Well, it's the King of the North, isn't it? And the book of Revelation brings this out even more clearly. In Revelation 13, the power that brings the final conflict is one that enforces a false worship through coercion, force, and law. All those are hallmarks of the King of the North. That is where the final, ultimate threat lies. But we have to be aware of both sides, and we can't go sliding into the camp of the King of the South as we attempt to deal with the claims of the King of the North. So where is the middle way? How do you speak to the concerns, to the legitimate concerns that both sides have? They're both pointing, we can agree in some ways with the critiques that both sides are bringing to the other, right? And it's easier for us to see this perhaps on the right side, the things that James Dobson says or some of the religious leaders are saying about the secularists and the relativists and the gay marriage, the pornographers on the left. You know, we understand that those are bad things. But we can also, with those on the left who are worried about the separation of church and state and civil liberties, we have sympathy with that. How do we tailor our message so it's heard in both camps, because that's who we're trying to reach. The wise are trying to turn many, both on the left and the right, to Christ. And there's no sense in unnecessarily offending either group. You know, we're not out to castigate the religious right for what they do or the secularist left. We're out to understand them and to try to reach them. Where is the middle way, the way of heavenly wisdom that is both pure and peaceable, that embraces both freedom and morality? I believe the Bible has an answer. Psalm 77:13 says, "Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary." We as Adventists of all people should know what a remarkable doctrine the sanctuary message is, but often we only talk about it in terms of defending it from attack. We've lost or often overlook the strong affirmative role that our sanctuary understanding gives us in understanding the balance between freedom and forgiveness on the one hand, and morality and principles of right and wrong on the other hand. And the sanctuary truth has played a central role in the ongoing battle between the kings of the North and the kings of the South. Historically it has, since the time of the Protestant Reformation, and I'm going to go into that to show that historically in the next lecture, and I believe that role is only going to get bigger, and it was the sanctuary doctrine that Luther and Calvin used to really overturn the papacy and to bring in systems of democratic government in the West, well, not them directly, but those who studied them. And I think that the sanctuary message as we understand it, with 1844 and the Day of Atonement, the Judgment Hour message, particularly helps answer the conflict between the King of the North and the King of the South today. And it can help put our message on a track that will resolve these great questions, these great dilemmas that are being raised for us. But I think that we're coming down to the last 10 minutes of this lecture, so I will invite... We end at 11:30, right? Or is it... Oh, 11:45. Okay, so I do have a few more minutes. I don't have to end so abruptly. I think what I'm going to do, there's a chalkboard over here, and there's a little chart that people often find helpful that I will use. Sometimes it's helpful to see this in model form, and it will help lay the foundation for the next lecture. You can kind of diagram the way that the King of the North views the relationship of three or four fundamental components, if you will. The existence of God, and obviously truth that goes with that, was something that the medieval church took very seriously. And they believed in the existence of truth, both spiritually and politically, and that this truth was given to humanity through certain avenues. And those avenues were the church, C stands for church, and the state. They believed in a priesthood. Can you hear me now? All right. not a commercial for Verizon. So the individual was at the bottom of this structure. And mediated, truth was mediated, church and state cooperated together. The state would enforce the prerogatives of the church, and the church was actually considered, I should make this line slightly shorter, superior to the state. The church was the ultimate authority. And this was the way it was for 1,000 years in Europe. People were kept pretty much in the dark, and rather than having rights, people had privileges that the church or the state would give them or not, or withdraw. And there was a divine right of kings and papal authority and priestly authority. And the individual stood at the bottom of the stack. Well, the Protestant Reformation came along and turned this pyramid on its head, nearly. God and truth, the Protestant Reformers still believed in God and truth, but they believed that the individual had direct access through Jesus in the heavenly sanctuary, right? We're not talking about the sanctuary doctrine, just parts of it that we don't maybe associate with the Day of Atonement, but it was the sanctuary doctrine that led them to believe that. And because of that, then, the church and the state were now playing a supporting role. And obviously it was papal authority that was attacked first, but after it became clear that there was no special role that a spiritual leader had, how much longer could the idea survive that in fact kings were anointed and appointed by God? And I think that through various philosophies, through Milton and John Locke and others who were philosophers very directly influenced by the Reformation, that you come to Lincoln's government by the people and for the people and of the people. That's what the government existed for. Previously, the people had existed for the king, but now the government existed for the people. And there was a growing idea that these were two separate spheres, that there should be a separation between church and state, because the individual shouldn't be coerced in his relationship and his role to God. But, so this is the medieval view. This is the Protestant Reformation. But then you fast forward a few years to Enlightenment, at least the skeptical Enlightenment, changed things a bit. This did open some doors to folks who eventually denied that at least you could know an ultimate truth or God, that there were many small case truths, that the individual was still here, and the state was more important than the church, but that church and state should be separate because, under this view, it was the fact that there were no absolutes that protected the individual in his role. Because if you can't know truth, you can't enforce it on other people, therefore the state should protect the individual. So the church is sort of a threat because people in church often believe there is an absolute truth. And those are the only kinds of people that could upset this whole system, right? So you keep the church separate and you marginalize it and you keep it outside because those church people are a little bit crazy. You know, faith is sort of irrational and we don't want that kind of thing getting into government. And in the 20th century, civil liberties and civil rights and the separation of church and state has become largely identified with that philosophical framework. And this one has been largely overlooked or set aside. And on September 11, when the planes flew into those buildings, they also knocked down not just towers, but they knocked down this system of thought, at least in the popular mind, because Americans, for the most part, have a hard time being relativists. But especially after September 11, how can you convince people there is no such thing as good and bad and wrong and right and evil? And we know some truths. We know that the terrorists were wrong and that they need to be brought to justice and that we should do that. And so this crumbled. This system crumbled and leadership, the administration, had recognized that it crumbled and said, all right, we have an alternative. And the alternative that we're going back to is this one here. People have in their minds these two alternatives and have almost entirely overlooked the fact that the original system of civil liberties and separation of church and state and religious freedom also had to do with the belief in the existence of truth and absolute truths. It was just an understanding of truth that led to tolerance and respect for civil liberties. So those three models will help you understand where we came from the Reformation in setting up America, and what's happened in our secular world. And often people who argue for the separation of church and state are immediately classed with this sort of system of thought and philosophy. But really, Adventism and Protestantism is about that. And it's that that we will look at the next session, in the next presentation. So why don't we have a few questions, if there are any. How do the principles of religious liberty weigh on the great controversy theme? And, you know, clearly it's central to the great controversy theme because we had a tree in the Garden of Eden that allowed humanity choice. And so from the very beginning, Satan raised questions about God's character, and God, instead of uncreating him or destroying him, allowed those questions to be asked and allowed for a history to unfold so those answers would be seen by others rather than merely accepted on God's authority. The creation itself with the tree in the Garden of Eden giving humanity a choice between wrong and right was itself the beginnings of religious liberty here on earth. The fact that Christ, God's Son, needed to go to the cross and die, that was a sacrifice that protected, that was in defense of, that was only necessary because of human freedom. And it wasn't, but what is the, you know, is the ultimate value freedom? And I suppose that may be Satan's response, but it's not. The ultimate value is love, which is only made possible by freedom. And, you know, why do we have history? Why did God not come after the cross, after the sacrifice was made? I think we've had these 2,000 years to show the interplay of governments, of church and state, of principles of coercion and freedom. I think that we're here in the final lap, if you will. There was a historian a number of years ago who wrote the book The End of History, and his thesis was that sort of human experimentation with governments is over. We see that a liberal democracy with freedom and capitalism is the form of government that everybody's aspiring to. You know, it's not that everybody has it, it's that everybody's aspiring to it, at least, for the most part. Even communist China is moving towards various capitalistic sorts of implementations. The leadership isn't free yet, but the people aspire to it. I think what it shows, though, is that the best human government that can be devised, the best principles of government, will still lead to intolerance and persecution and a denial of freedoms, and that God's government is the only government based on His Ten Commandments that can ultimately offer both civil and spiritual freedom. So I'm not sure what your question was getting at specifically, but those are some general thoughts about the great controversy in religious liberty. Well, you know, if you were going to sit down and write a kind of novelized version of last day events, as some people have done in the past, and you were focusing on the political framework, and I mean, you couldn't really write something any more dramatic than has happened in the last 3 or 4 years, with the attacks of September 11, with a political response to that. Every time I go through the airport and have to sort of half undress and take my shoes off, and we're just becoming conditioned on all sides to kind of accept increasing security and routinization in our lives. And as Adventists, when I travel and I talk about it, you know, isn't the devil so clever that he brings about this tremendous, almost radical cutback in constitutional freedoms and protections, and he does it in a way that has many, if not most, Adventists applauding? That we're all focused on this terrorism threat, and indeed it is a real threat, but you know, the terrorists have done far more than knock down the Twin Towers and injured the Pentagon if at their first attacks we abandon our whole experiment with constitutional democracy. We haven't abandoned it entirely, of course, but it's amazing how quick we are to sort of walk away from some of the many of the fundamental precepts. And they're far more successful in their attacks than they'd thought or maybe hoped. And it doesn't have to do with knocking down buildings. It has to do with a changed character of the American people and our willingness. We don't realize the power of precedent. We think, oh, these laws have to do with terrorists and Islamicists. But when a law is changed, that precedent is set for you, for me, and for other Americans. And if you become a part of an unpopular minority at some point in the future, it's like St. Thomas More said in the famous movie A Man for All Seasons, when his zealous son-in-law said he would cut down all the laws in England to get to the devil. And Thomas More said, well, and where would you stand in the winds that would blow then, when there were no protections for you? The devil would turn on you and you would be gone. Well, we pray that's the case, don't we? Because it... You know, the situation in the earth is such that you don't know how there can be second chances this time around. In other words, the winds that were being held back in the 1880s and 1890s didn't include nuclear rogue states and, nuclear Pakistans and Indias. And the stakes are so much bigger now. And once things start slipping out of control, how long can God's omnipotent, I suppose he could, but it just seems that we're rapidly reaching a point of no return. You see verse 42 as a reference to the neocons in Washington who are wanting to not just invade Iraq, but Iran and... pretend to understand the details of all these verses, and if someone here does, I'll be happy to talk with them, but... You know, clearly the last great conflict is an international one, and we should expect all the nations lining up to be involved. And it's unclear how communist China might fit into this or some of the more hardened Islamic countries, but things are happening overseas, and America is becoming the last great superpower, and it's involving itself in these areas. And You know, as quickly as communism fell, these other issues and obstacles can resolve themselves as well. Yeah, that's a good question. And I'm just to help me understand it, your reference to creation and creationism, is that you're referring to the intelligent design? Well, no, I think we should be doing more in this area of creation and intelligent design. You know, if you go back to the three angels' messages, the first angel's message is clearly a reference to creation. Worship him, the judgment hour message, worship him who made heaven and earth, the seas and the fountains of waters. And since 1859, when Darwin published The Origin of the Species, that's the philosophy that undergirds, if you will, the King of the South. And our inspired response to that is the story of creation and evidences for creation. And early in the 20th century, Adventists were at the forefront of leading out in recovering the creation story, George McCready Price and others. Now, the modern creationist movement has drawn from those men, but the Adventists are less involved with it for some reason. And the Sabbath issue is connected to it, the judgment issue is connected with it, with the flood, and eventually the sanctuary. And there are some people who are doing some things, but I'm very high on using creation. At a church I was at in Maryland for a couple of years, our best outreach was a creation society that we started. And it was mostly non-Adventist Christians that would come to it. And it allowed you to talk about not just creation, but a wide range of important spiritual issues for these days. So I think the intelligent design, you know, right now, people are concerned about intelligent design and perhaps establishing religion, but right now we have secular humanism in the form of evolution being established every day in public classrooms across America. And that's wrong. And I think intelligent design is just an attempt to get an equal hearing for what is at heart a scientific system that happens to be consistent with Christianity and other belief systems. Todd.
First a comment and then a question.
Sure. Well, that's a good question. You know, it was, as I studied 19th century America, it became clear that while slavery was eradicated in 1865, at the end of the Civil War, with the 13th Amendment, that the system of racial segregation almost only worsened for the next 50 or 60 years, and true civil rights were denied, largely African Americans, but also other Americans. And it had to do with the North's interest in industrialization and commercialization and desire to work cooperatively with Southern industrial leaders. And in a sense, commerce and commercial interests can get in the way of, can delay, can become an enemy of civil freedoms. And, you know, there's a personal application to that as well. If I'm caught up in earning money and making a good business life for myself, it's very easy to put matters of principle and conscience on the back burner. And I'm not saying you can't work for corporate America. I did for a number of years. But at some point, there are choices you have to make that may cause you to subordinate. If you're going to be faithful to your conscience, they're going to cost you some money. It works at the individual level, and it works at the level of nations. That's a very good question, and sometimes I need to make sure that I have that in my presentation, because there's a balance to it. Ellen White did support abolition as well as prohibition, and she was very vocal in her support for the temperance movement and the enforcement by law of what many people would consider a moral issue. And I think that a kind of a nice divide are the Ten Commandments themselves. If you look at the first four commandments, they govern our relationship to God, and the second six govern our relationship to our fellow men and women. And that division can be an effective guide, I think, as to whether the government should be involved. Prayer in schools, Ten Commandments relating to the first four, the kind of worship you do, supporting sectarian schools or worship, it's largely the first four. The last six, you know, issues of, and I know I differ with some on this, but issues relating to pornography, to sexual morality, those can be difficult ones. Clearly, I think the Supreme Court got it right when they said you can't criminalize gay behavior. Two consenting adults do in private that doesn't impact others is their business. But then I think that the state, because it's the second six, it has to do with the family, the state has a legitimate interest in protecting the family unit. And I think there are legitimate laws against kinds of pornography and obscenity in that kind of morality where there can be shown to be a direct and clear societal interest. So we need to be balanced and recognize that Ellen White did take moral stands on some issues.
For additional CDs of this message or for other presentations by these speakers and others associated with ACM, you may contact us as follows. In the United States and Canada, dial our toll-free order line, 800-233-4450. International calls, dial 717-652-7000. Fax orders, dial 717-652-9050. Our internet email address is info@americancassette.org. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. Our entire catalog is online, and we accept MasterCard, Visa, and Discover credit cards. Maintaining the integrity of the Three Angels' messages since 1975, American Cassette Ministries, a 501c3 nonprofit ministry, is dependent upon your generous tax-deductible contributions in order to maintain our low prices and to continue providing you the finest genuine Adventist preaching until Jesus comes. He's coming soon.